Well, good morning, Tucsonans. This is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in here for Ted Maxwell. I'm obviously not Ted Maxwell. He's much taller and more handsome than I. Here on The Morning Voice, your trusted source for local news and talk. This is I normally host the American Warrior radio show, heard Saturdays at noon here on KVOI, and then we do Best of Sundays at 3 p.m. What a privilege to be sitting in for Ted today. You know, Brendan behind the glass. I tell you, folks, one thing I love about this format is that I see the Morning Voice as sort of the all-you-can-eat buffet of talk radio. You know, a different host every day, a real diverse group of topics, and it's fun. It's a pleasure. It's very, very informative. So we've got a jam-packed show this morning. Coming up at 7:30, we've got Miguel Ortega, who you might recognize that name. He's the former Tucson city manager. He's now been appointed to be the interim head of PAG, which is also responsible for the RTA. We'll also be doing a wrap-up, kind of a rear-view mirror view of what happened at the legislature this year. So that will be very interesting. In my day job, I'm a lobbyist. But we're going to start off this morning with Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes. Did you know that half of the fentanyl that is captured, seized in the U.S. right now comes through our Grand Canyon State? Half the fentanyl seizures come right through here in Arizona. This past November, Arizona voters overwhelmingly passed Prop 314. And what that would do is it would make it a state crime for non-citizens to enter our state at any location other than a designated port of entry. It also makes it a Class 2 felony for anyone convicted of selling fentanyl, resulting in the death of another person. Now, while Prop 314 is currently tied up in the courts, it's tied to a law in Texas, what the proposition did not do is allocate any additional funding to enforce the law. Joining us this morning to discuss the issue is the president of the Arizona Sheriff's Association, currently serving as a sheriff of Yavapai County, David Rhodes. Sheriff Rhodes, welcome to the Morning Voice.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be here. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm not bad. It's a beautiful day here in Southern Arizona. Now, for our listeners who are geographically challenged, Sheriff Rhodes, the county seat of Yavapai County is Prescott, correct?
That's right. Prescott, Sedona is another prominent community that's in Yavapai. Yep.
Now, Sheriff, in my world, you know, telling someone they have to do something without providing dollars is called an unfunded mandate. What can you give us? What is the status of Prop 314 now as you understand it?
Well, like you said, you know, it's tied to the Texas law, HB4 in Texas, which is being litigated. I believe it's under appeal in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so nothing is happening with it at the moment. However, depending on the outcome of that ruling, then it could become a state, you know, it could go into effect. And I think, you know, there's a couple pieces to it. The fentanyl piece, you know, the mandatory sentencing for the fentanyl sales that result in a death is an important part to remember. There's the employer sanctions for, you know, knowingly, you know, hiring people that are in the country illegally to evade, you know, taxes or anything like that. But the big piece is like what you mentioned, and which is it would make it a state crime to essentially come through a hole in the fence or, you know, any of these undesignated entries. And so if that goes into effect, well, then that state law is in effect. But there would need to be funding for those four border counties really to be able to enforce that. Now, I will say this. Since the change in the federal administration, things have been wildly different. And there's just not, you know, the need really to enforce that law right now, because you're just not seeing as much illegal border crossings as we saw before. But you know, the state's got to come through with the money. And we said that, the sheriff said that from the very beginning, you know, the minute that we heard about this proposition, the minute that we worked on putting it on the ballot and the Sheriff's Association supported it, we said there would have to be funding, and the legislators acknowledged that. And, you know, to that point, the local border security fund was funded again this year at $18 million, jointly agreed to by the legislature and the governor.
Sorry, you mentioned that, because I clearly we can all see there has been a change with the new Trump administration, where the I don't want to say the pressure's off, but certainly the numbers are significantly down of illegal border crossers, some of whom are, you know, bringing fentanyl into the country. But the, so as I understand it, originally when Prop 314 passed, your organization was asking for $50 million. You agreed to reduce that to $23 million. So from what I'm hearing from you, so the legislature still did not quite get you there.
No, they didn't. But, you know, we asked for $50 million. You got to remember, when we put that ask in, it was December of 2024. Mm-hmm. And we were in the worst situation that this state's ever been in. The entire country's ever been in. The border was leaking like it had, you know, like a sieve. Yeah. Where people were coming across by the hundreds of thousands. And so when we asked for $50 million, it was based on that. Now, we had also been saying, the sheriffs had also been saying, is, you know, this is public safety is our thing, and deterrence is the major factor in law enforcement. We had been asking for the executive, the president of the United States, to tell the rest of the world that the border was not open and America's laws would be enforced, and we weren't getting that under the previous administration. We're getting that now, and you're seeing how that works. You know, the authority figure, the president of the United States, telling people that the laws are going to be enforced, they believe them.
Yeah.
And so they're not coming. And so when that happened, and we started to look at the declining numbers, well, there wasn't utility for $50 million anymore. And I think the sheriffs, I know the sheriffs, want to be good stewards of taxpayer money. We want to use money where it's needed and whatnot. And we do care about other things in the community, because public safety has everything to do with, you know, population health, like education and, you know, healthcare and roads and all these kind of things. So the idea was, is, you know, that $25 million or the reduction in the ask, we wanted the legislature to use that money for other things that would make the communities healthier and safer.
I tell you what, sir, I was, last time I guest hosted here, we had a representative of the Department of Public Safety on. And I am just shocked at what, you know, our listeners may not know this, but the only counties in the state that have 7-day-a-week, 24-hour coverage from DPS are Maricopa and Pima. And so,
yeah,
like,
no, that's true.
Up in your country, sir, if, you know, if I'm broken down outside, well, I mean, obviously the deputies are going to be available to respond, but, and they did not get their money out of the legislature this year. And some of the facilities they're using are just appalling. So
no, DPS needs, they definitely need, you know, more funding. But I will tell you, to that point, DPS is able to function that way in the rest of the state because they're not, you know, the primary law enforcement agency in the counties, the sheriff's offices, right. You know, when you read the Arizona Constitution, the sheriff is responsible for law enforcement in the counties, the chief law enforcement officer in the county. And so the counties have to pay for that. And the sheriffs have to provide it. And, you know, but DPS, they're an amazing support agency, great partners, mm-hmm. whatnot, but they're not able to be fully funded and functional. And, you know, you're talking about 13 counties where now the troopers are on call and they get called out if they're needed, but they're not out there.
Sir, I want to come back to that. I just was also talking to someone about the scourge of human trafficking, you know, right here in the U.S. And correct me if I'm wrong, but from my perspective, in Arizona, every county is a border county. You know, it doesn't have to be Santa Cruz or Cochise or you know, Yuma County. I mean, you're seeing the impacts of this all the way up north in your communities too, I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's we are dealing with, you know, because what happens is once you get across the border, the open border, you know, it foments the illicit economies that, you know, plague your communities all over the state and all over the country. So the drug trafficking, the human trafficking, whether it's, you know, for forced labor or labor exploitation or sex trafficking, whatever it is, those things start to occur in every community in this state. And you know, the border becomes the commodity. You know, the cartels control the south side of the border, access to it. People have to pay a lot of money. They don't have money. So they, you know, are brought here to the United States with the idea that they're going to work and that they're going to do this and then do that and pay off their debt. But that, guess what? That debt's never paid. And so, you know, you start, and then those people that are up here illegally, you know, they're under the threat of deportation a lot. And so, you know, it's quite a, I mean, it's a system that, you know, you got to pay attention to. And so this is the fallout of not enforcing the law, right? Like, nobody pays attention to it. And so all these informal systems, economies, criminal activity come up. And that's what you have.
I almost see this, sir. I was a criminal justice major in college, and I almost see this as a nationwide version of the broken windows theory. And now,
100%, 100%. And just to your point, you know, broken windows was just a study done in Kansas City a long time ago, where they parked a car in a high crime area and left it sitting there and in pristine condition. Nobody touched it. And then they went and broke a window. And, you know, within a short period of time, that car had been stripped. And that's the point, is that if there's a respect among society that the laws will be enforced, then you gain that voluntary compliance. And if that respect goes away, then you don't.
Yeah. I'm curious. When I come back, we've got to take a break here in a little bit, Sheriff. When I come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the budget side of things. Because, again, if I'm Pima County, Maricopa County, and maybe Yavapai, I'm not sure what your situation is up there, you know, they potentially can absorb some of this through their county budgets. But, you know, Santa Cruz County, Cochise, Yuma, you know, Navajo, Apache, you know, those folks don't have as large a tax base as some of the rest of us do, and that could be a challenge for them. So, sir, if you don't mind, we'll touch that when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting here for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell right here on KVOI, your trusted source for local news and talk. We're talking with Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes about... So we have the sheriff. We don't have the sheriff.
I think he needs to call back.
Okay,
if he's so, listening right now, because his phone call just dropped.
So
right as
I
came
hate to
back.
Say this, but somebody needs to put out a bolo for the sheriff, huh?
You know, pretty much,
be
yeah.
On the lookout. So yeah. So Brendan, ladies and gentlemen, Brendan is behind the glass working for us today. Matt is usually the person, but Brendan is relatively new, right?
Just since the beginning of January, or about halfway through January is when I started doing.
So I tell you, I'm not, everybody who's listened to me before knows I am not a morning drive guy. Not a fan. But every once in a while it's kind of cool to do it. But, you know, we're lucky to be able to do radio. So on the topic here, Brennan, you're lifelong Tucsonan?
Yes, born and raised right here in Tucson.
So you've seen... You know, in my neighborhood, Laura and I live right in the center of Tucson by the U of A. And, you know, in our neighborhood, I mean, some of the convenience stores and stuff, I mean, I see the, you know, the folks with the fentanyl bends and the, you know, the meth zombies and stuff like that.
100%.
And it's just out of control. And I'll be curious to see from a strictly a, you know, supply and demand standpoint, how the federal administration's new emphasis on actually shutting down the border, theoretically reducing the supply, what that's going to do to, you know, the folks out there on the street. I would think, you know, normally you'd think, well, then of course the price of those drugs is going to go up, and how is that going to impact? And I don't know if you know this, but Tucson's property crime rate is about 33% higher than it should be for a city of our size, and a lot of that's driven by the drug habits, unfortunately.
Yeah, that does sound about right for what you see and hear around town.
And I anticipate if the price of those drugs goes up, then the need to potentially commit more crime to fuel that. And, you know, I'm not trying to judge those folks or not, but I mean, darn it, if you're busting out the window of my car to steal a DVD off the seat.
Right, exactly. Like, it's, you can only go so far. Of course, you never know anyone's specific situation, but when it's happening to almost everybody that you see on the street, it's just a little crazy.
It's kind of heartbreaking, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Because I don't. I used to volunteer with a group that worked with homeless teens and street kids, Brendan, and there was always not a debate, but you know, the question was always, well, do drugs lead to life on the street, or if you're having to live on the street, does that push you into drugs? Because I know for some of the young people, our demographic was all kids under the age of 18. And it's horrible to think about that, a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old out there on the streets. But the sad reality for many of the young people we worked with was living under a bridge in Tucson was infinitely better than what they ran away from. You know, a lot of them came out of the foster care system or some kind of abusive relationship in their home. And so, I don't want to judge the folks who just happen to be using drugs out there, but it is a huge problem. And I don't know, they do this point in time count here locally, and they go out and try and survey and see how many, you know, homeless are out there on the street. Now, I've always been a little bit not trusting of those numbers because, for example, with our kids, because they're runaways, they don't want to be found, you know, so they're not going to self-identify to some random, you know, schmo coming up with a clipboard and saying, hey, are you homeless or not? So anyway, the long story short is the latest survey did show a significant increase in the homeless in Tucson. So it's definitely getting worse rather than better.
Yeah. And when it comes to problems like fentanyl, it's not always as cut and dry as it's like it's because they're homeless and things like that. It's mainly like the people you surround yourself with, things like that. I've had fentanyl problems in my family before.
Oh boy.
And it's mainly the kind of people you surround yourself with, who's there, you know, and what's going on in the household, things like that.
I'm sad to hear that.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, and it can happen truly to anybody, you know. Fentanyl has become such a huge problem in this country that it's not even like it's a specific thing that you can just get off the street. It can be laced into something that you don't even know that you're taking. Who knows, like, where it is sometimes. You know, you always got to be vigilant and careful with what you're doing, and sometimes people make a mistake, and it's really, you know, the consequences can be severely dire, and it's not even necessarily like if they're doing well in life or have a good station, it's just the situation. And that's why, like you said, sometimes it's kind of better for like a young teen to be homeless, because maybe the situation at home is not great.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's better,
it's not
but
better.
You know, it's maybe not as bad. So I'm curious, you know, so much of this comes to, in my opinion, so much of it comes down to leadership or the lack thereof. And I know it's you haven't been around as long as I have, Brendan, but, you know, sometimes in life there's going to be things that you don't want to face because it's not pleasant. And that, you know, might be a personal issue in your life. It might be something in your community. But in general, my opinion, sir, is that we have ignored that problem for too long here in Tucson, just because nobody wants to. I don't say nobody, but it's easier to talk about something that's a little more, you know, sunshine and rainbows. And it's
100%.
Yeah. So speaking of which, leadership, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget today is Election Day. If you happen to live in Congressional District 7, which I do, which is mostly in Tucson, is mostly, you know, north, northwest. Today's Election Day. Don't forget, if you have that ballot still sitting on your kitchen table, obviously it's too late to mail it in, but there are a number of locations around Tucson where you can drop those off. Go to pima.gov/elections to find those locations throughout southern Arizona. And it's quite the kerfuffle, Brennan. I mean, on the Democrat side, you can choose between former Senator, State Representative Daniel Hernandez, Pima County Supervisor Adelita Grijalva, social media influencer Deja Fox, indigenous activist Jose Malvido, and former healthcare executive Patrick Harris Sr. Brendan, please explain to me what an influencer is.
It's a person of influence. I mean, it's mostly, when it's someone so tied to social media, really getting out there and trying to do as many kinds of posts and stories on like Facebook or Instagram, things like that. I know that Deja Fox is very big on Instagram, which is why I think she's hitting a lot with obviously a younger ish generation, you know, but my generation specific. She's younger than me, but
right, she's barely legal age to run for Congress, which
yeah
is 25.
I think she's exactly legal age to run for Congress.
So
and it's such a wide difference between her and the any other candidate. And I think she's one of the most vocal candidates, and because she's using her experiences doing things as an influencer on these social media platforms, which no other candidate is pushing that hard like that.
So riddle me this. Aren't talk radio hosts the original influencers?
Yes, 100%.
Okay, so why do I not have people sending me sacks of cash to promote their ball gowns or skincare products? It's a fair question, Brendan.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, it is interesting because people, when I was growing up, people were like, oh, radio's dead. It's like radio's not dead in the slightest. And even if like, that's what podcasts are anyway. Podcasts are just radio. Like, that's what it's turned into now.
I say this with complete love and respect in my heart because... are you familiar with the term pod fade?
Yeah.
And I don't know what the number is, but you know, your average podcast only lasts like, what, 6-7 episodes. People don't realize how much work it is. For my show, I've got a 1-hour show and I do, what, 4 to 6 hours of show prep just for 1 hour of content.
And yeah, it's crazy.
So, and I was kind of chuckling because I heard another talk show host who was, and this is his opinion, not mine. I want to issue that disclaimer, but you know, he says, you know, podcasters, they're only podcasting because they're not good enough to do radio. His words, not mine. Okay. I mean, there's a lot of great podcasts out there. I love them, but yeah. So I just coming back to CD7 on, and by the way, if you happen to see the Yavapai County Sheriff out there, please have him call in. But on the Republican side in the CD7 race, you've got small business owner Danielle Gutierrez, restaurant owner Jose Rivas, and business owner Jimmy Rodriguez. One thing that stands out to me, Brendan, in this whole situation is on the Republican side, all small business owners. But on the Dem side, there's only one, Patrick Harris, who was a former healthcare executive who, you know, had a day job, if you will. And I don't know, I guess maybe an influencer could be called an entrepreneur, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I think most are starting to become entrepreneurs.
Okay, fair enough. So we'll give Deja Fox some credit for that. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. Stick around. We got lots of great content coming up. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell. And way to go, Brendan. Brendan, you're too young to remember this music. What are you doing playing this?
I grew up on this music.
Oh, when you were 5, maybe.
I remember very well.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're here on your trusted source for local news and talk. If you'd like to interact with us, give us a call, 520-790-2040. We're going to talk on a subject now that has been pretty much on the radar for any Tucson that's been paying attention. On June 16th, former Tucson City Manager Michael Ortega was appointed Interim Executive Director of the Pima Association of Governments, which includes responsibility for the RTA. He was selected via unanimous vote by the Pima Association of Governments Regional Council. Ortega steps into a position at a time of, I'll use the quotation fingers, Mike, dynamic time for the RTA's history. An election on the renewal of the half-cent sales tax is looming on the horizon, potentially, and a number of projects from the original RTA are falling short. We're privileged to have you here with us. Mike Ortega, welcome to The Morning Voice.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
I will tell you, Mike, I've worked with you before in other capacities, and I was very pleased and frankly relieved when you were appointed as the interim director. But at the same time, Mike, I was thinking, what on earth were you thinking, brother? I mean, you were going fishing. You were done.
I was actually in my wood shop making sawdust when I got a phone call.
Literally.
Okay. It's actually pretty funny. But now I'm really, really blessed to be here and have the opportunity to maybe help out. And that's basically what I told the regional council is, you know, if you think I can help you and I think I've got some skill sets that might be able to assist, I'm happy to do it.
Do you remember John Jones? Does that ring a bell? He used to work for the city of Tucson.
I remember. Absolutely. I remember John.
So from my perspective, John was sort of the utility infielder. When there was an issue that was kind of sporty or something that needed to be fixed, they assigned John to it and he got it done. So you've always sort of reminded me of that guy in our community. So like I said, I'm very pleased to to see you do that. Just give us a real quick Reader's Digest version for folks who, I mean, RTA 1, I'll use that term, has been around going on 20 years. So more recent, Tucsonans that have just come to our community may not be familiar with it. So Reader's Digest version, what is RTA and what is it doing for our community, Mike?
Sure. First of all, I want to just thank you for the compliment of a utility player. As a former pitcher, I know exactly what utility players do, and that's a huge compliment. So thank you, Ben. I appreciate that. So the RTA was actually created or established by the voters. I mean, so if you think about it, the voters in 2006 basically said to the Pima Association of Governments, we're going to entrust you with about $2.1 billion, and we'll get to that here in a minute, to fix our roads and a variety of transportation-related type projects and programs. So the voters are really the ones that established that relationship and entrusted this group with getting these roads addressed and the programs fixed.
And how are we didn't quite get there, right? I mean that because honestly, I was a big fan, still am a big fan of RTA because I believe that when it first was established, Mike, I saw that as a path forward to more regional cooperation, which our community, and I've been here, 40 years, and our community, you know, desperately needed that. I don't want to say we need to go to a complete metro model like Las Vegas, but I had a lot of hope for that, that one might create other spin-off cooperative efforts. And I think to some extent it has done that. But in fairness, there are, for lots of reasons that you can probably share, there are some projects that were on that original list of projects that aren't going to make it. They're not going to get finished, right? And I don't know what the number is. Is it 13 out of 35?
So I'm going to actually suggest to you to use a different language. They're not finished yet.
Okay, fair enough.
And I think it's important, right? Because I think there is a rhetoric out there. There is a story out there that these aren't going to get done. They're not going to get finished. That's not true. I think that the regional council has previously made a commitment to finish these projects one way or another. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've been asked to look at is how do we do that? Now, I can tell you that it's really tough when you're short the significant revenue that did not come in, right? I mean, let's just start there. But the reality is that I think back to your point, the regional cooperation, I think, is extremely important, if nothing more to have the dialogue. You know, every time that the regional council meets, it gives them an opportunity to talk about things, particularly region-wide concerns. But it also gives an opportunity for different communities to sit next to each other, their mayors to sit next to each other and work out, you know, other issues, if you will.
Well, and we certainly saw that during COVID. I mean, there's a lot of things that can change in 20 years. And you know, you forecast your revenues, but things can happen. You know, revenues, they don't, like you said, they just don't come in. And Lord knows, in the housing industry, which I'm involved with in my day job, you know, the price of lumber, the price of concrete, I mean, there's a lot of dynamics out there that we have no control over. And I'm assuming the same thing applies to the price of asphalt and, you know, the underground utilities and all the stuff involved with some of this road work.
Yeah, so one of the things that I looked at, Ben, was what exactly has gotten us into this situation. And so I started really dissecting our revenues. And our original revenue projections were in the vicinity of about $2.7 billion. And we actually only took in, right, $1.7
billion. Wow.
So when you look at those kinds of hits, right, it's like, wow, wait a minute, what do we do, right? And so to the regional council's credit, they really have scrounged and scraped all monies that are coming into the region and said the RTA completion of the program as a whole is extremely important. We've got to figure out ways to do that. And so they've put a tremendous amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars from other sources into this program. And one of the options, obviously, moving forward is for that to continue for an extended period of time until all of those programs are, in fact, delivered as promised to the voters.
So really, we're flipping this thing on its head, and you're right. I stand corrected. So maybe a better way to look at it, I don't do math in public, Mike. You're the math genius, not me. But maybe a better way to look at it, given those numbers, those budget numbers that you threw out, is, hey, 22 projects are done and in the ground, and we're working on the other 13. That's maybe a different lens to look at it, but maybe a more accurate lens.
Well, absolutely. And so one of the things, the other thing that I did was look at the program as a whole. So we hear a lot of numbers thrown out there in terms of projects that aren't complete and so forth and so on. The reality is we've completed more than, you know, going through this effort, we've completed more than are left to complete,
sure.
Right? And so, you know, that's kind of obvious because of the numbers. But if we don't have a plan for how those get completed, then it you know, it leads to speculation about, well, maybe they're not going to get done.
One thing I also want to share from my perspective is, because I see this coming down the track as clear as day, this RTA Next, the renewal, it's not a new tax. You're just asking the voters to renew that same half-cent sales tax that's already in place and folks are already paying now.
That's correct. And so the conversation is really, that's an option. Okay, in terms of how do we complete some of the original projects in RTA 1. And so that's where things get muddy for folks. But actually, they're very simple in terms of understanding. So the revenues didn't come in on RTA 1. And so there's probably a couple of different options. One is to continue to pour regional money into the RTA 1. The other is to go to the voter and say, hey, we had made some assumptions back 20 years ago that didn't quite pan out. So let's have a conversation with the voter about that. And so they have an opportunity to weigh in on that and give us some direction in terms of the next 20 years and what that looks like. And it really is about the program delivery, but also respectful of what the voters had asked us to look at.
Has there been any forecasting done for, let's say, the next 20 years if RTA Next is passed and implemented? And are those forecasts, let's say, a little more conservative than the last time around?
That's a great question. So the short answer is yes to both, right? Yes, there have been projections made, but they're also more conservative. So in this original projection back in 06, actually it was 05, but in the 05-06 year, we took the baseline, which is kind of like what was expected to occur. In this future scenario, we've actually run projections, and we don't do them in-house. We actually hire the University of Arizona. You know, Dr. Hammond does amazing work, as you know, in your other day job.
Yeah.
and so what we've done, though, is taken the board has taken the pessimistic version of that. So they usually give us three levels, you know, pessimistic, baseline, and optimistic, and we've picked the lower one. It's about $2.4 billion in the future 20 years.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. If you have a question, feel free to call. We're very privileged to have a gentleman I consider quite the expert on a lot of different things, but we're talking RTA. That phone number is 790-2040. We'll be back with more from Mike Ortega and the Regional Transportation Authority. Stick around. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia, BBG, sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. If you'd like to have a question or comment, give us a call, 790-2040. We're very privileged to have Mike Ortega in studio with us, who I'll admit, Mike, I'm a fan of your work. You shepherded the city of Tucson through some very interesting and challenging times while you were the city manager, and you deserved a break, but now you're back with the heart of service as the interim director of the of PAG, the Pima Association of Governments. What, Mike, interim is for how long? So what's the main task that's sitting on your desk now?
So the regional council, when they asked me to come on board and help, basically asked me to do two things. One of them is to get the RTA Next in a package, if you will, ready to go to the voters. And the other is really making sure we have a foundation, which is the delivery of RTA 1. So those are separate, very related, but separate. And they've asked me to really look at those and say, okay, how do we get these accomplished? How do we get these done? And really the focus for the last, this is my, let's see, 17th day, for the last 16 days has really been on developing strategies for delivery of RTA 1. So what do we do? How do we do it? What are the ideas that we need to bring forward to the regional council for consideration on how we get these projects out the door?
So I just want to throw this out there, Mike. So 16, 17 days. So the very first radio show you did was The Morning Voice, right?
That's it. I'm here. You called and I'm like, here I am.
Yay for us. So who pulls the trigger on whether, because we still don't know whether there's going to be an election or not, right? Or, I mean, so is that up to the regional council to say, okay, we've got we're comfortable. We've got something we feel comfortable taking to the voters, and then we forge ahead. And there's a ticking clock on this, though.
Yeah. So the direction has been to hold an election in March. That was the direction from some time ago. And so I'll give you the dates just so that you know some of the deadlines that I'm faced with as we start to look at that RTA next ballot measure. So the election would be March 10th. The Board of Supervisors has to call the election, which means that the ballot materials, including the plan, is 100% complete, and the Board of Supervisors then considers calling the election. That date, the last date possible, I believe September 10th or 11th, but they don't have a meeting on those dates, so it would be September 2nd. In order for the materials to get to the Board of Supervisors, the plan has to be in front of them or to them by August 26th.
So of this year.
Just here 6 weeks, 7 weeks from now. And so the regional council has to have the RTA board has to have a final plan and ballot language to the Board of Supervisors staff, basically, for posting by August 26th, which their meeting, the next closest date, is August 25th. So that Monday, that August 25th Monday, is when the final plan has to be accomplished, finished in hand, if the election is to occur March 10th. So wow. Those are the logistics.
So let me ask a question, Michael. When you were city manager, you were not, I don't want to say you weren't a fan, but you had some concerns. You had some cautionary words for the mayor and council about RTA Next. Obviously now you're in a different role and it's your job to shepherd this thing across the finish line. From your perspective, have we worked out some of those issues that have been creating a little bit of chaos down there with the regional council? And I mean, how comfortable are you that we've got something now that is, and at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the voters, right? So it's your job just to give them the facts and the information, let them decide.
You know, Ben, I really appreciate that question because I know it might be rattling around in some people's heads, right? When I was the city manager, I was very concerned about some of the things that I was seeing and hearing from the RTA, and particularly the inability, really, to articulate how we're going to finish RTA 1. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the reasons I expressed the concerns. And there were other factors and other issues which I think have evolved, you know, since I've been gone, which is great. Might be a correlation there. But today, because now I understand and know how we can finish RTA 1, and I'm very open and transparent about it, I think there is a little bit of a difference in terms of my opinion of it, and I think it's doable. I think there is a path there to accomplish RTA 1.
And if folks want to get better edumacated, which I highly recommend, they can go to your website and find out more information. It's all laid out there?
That's correct. So there's rtanext.com or rtamobility.com.
Okay.
Now, I wanted to just make one little clarification or just a differentiation. So the Pima Association of Governments is one entity. The RTA board is another entity. Same people, with the exception of one additional board member, but they have different roles, but I work for both, basically.
So I was going to ask that question. Who do you report to? So, okay, have we got enough time for this, Brendan? Or okay, we do have a caller. Charles is line one, has a question for Michael Ortega about the RTA. We're short on time, Charles, real quick, if you don't mind.
Real quick, if the RTA were not to get reauthorized, would it just stop, or would it peter out on the amount of money that's left and then sort of have an S? I'll take my answer on the air.
Great. Thanks for calling, Charles.
Charles, thank you for that. That's a great question and one that we are exploring. I can tell you this, if it goes away, in other words, if the voters do not reauthorize it, there's no other funding, there's two components to it. It's the delivery of the program, right, which are mostly roadway element projects, which the regional council has said, we're going to finish those. We're going to figure out a way to finish those. I've given them scenarios that soaks up all of the regional money till about 2036 or 2040. So all the regional money would go to that. The programmatic side, which is really, really troubling, is the transit side, some of the transit impacts to the region. So it's paratransit, dial-a-ride, those other regional transit pieces to the tune of about $31 million, $32 million a year is really the case.
Well, challenge. Thank you. Thank you for that call, Charles. Mike, thanks for coming and sharing your opinion on this. This is very important information. For what it's worth, ladies and gentlemen, BBG's endorsement is to vote to reauthorize RTA Next, and you can learn more. Visit rtanext.com. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Bueller Garcia, BBG, sitting in for Ted Maxwell. I think, Brendan, this is like the guest host week, because I'm sitting in for Bill later today and tomorrow. And then tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, on the Morning Voice, Dr. Ed Ackerley will be sitting in for Grant Kruger beginning at 7 a.m. right here on KVOY. He'll be talking with Craig White from KGUN and Rob Bonneau from KOLD about the state of local television here in the Old Pueblo. After Morning Voice is done, don't forget to stay tuned in for Win Tucson with Kathleen Wynn, a great show coming up at 9 o'clock here as well. Now, if you weren't keeping score at home, this year's Arizona legislative session was your typical endeavor, worthy of its own reality TV show. Luckily, they've adjourned, so our pocketbooks are safe for another few months. I've invited Steve Kaiser of Policy Forge to come on and give us a kind of a 2020 hindsight rearview mirror perspective on this session. Steve served 8 years as an officer in our United States Army. He's a seasoned veteran of the halls of the legislature as well, having served both in the House and the Senate. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us, especially Steve, since how you were probably still in your decompression period after this last legislative session.
Yeah, it always feels like when the session ends, it's kind of this big decompression is a great way to put it, but it's moving so fast and there's so many twists and turns that once it ends, it's just, you need to take a minute to catch your breath.
Steve, just a full disclaimer for any of the lawyers, listening in, you and I share a client, the Arizona Multi-Housing Association, so just that disclaimer so folks know going forward. Is it okay, Steve, to call you a lobbyist, or is there a kinder, gentler term we should use for, a family radio show?
No, lobbyist is fine. You can add, I don't know. I really enjoy it. I think it's been a perfect a balance because you get to work on policies that you really care about, and housing is one of those policy areas that I really care about. But it's just a lot better for your, personal freedom with your family and stuff like that. So
I tell you, I used to, in my day job, I still do, I call it advocacy locally. But in my earlier years, Steve, I did used to work the legislature, and I got to share that it's really interesting how the sausage is made, if you will. Folks, people mm-hmm. like to eat it, but they don't necessarily want to see it being made. One of my favorite things ever, though, Steve, was striker bills. I just mm-hmm. always loved knowing who had a striker in their bottom drawer in case things went sideways. So explain to our right. listeners what a striker is.
Yeah, strikers are really fascinating, and not every state does this process. Some states have something similar. They call it something different. But basically what a striker is, a smart lawmaker or a smart lobbyist will always have access to a couple strikers. And I started figuring this out after the first year. And so what you would do is you would say, as a lawmaker, you'd say, I have these priority bills that are really important to me, but I want to make sure that I have a life raft for them if they get stuck somewhere, because more bills die, obviously, than go through. And it's very easy for bills to die. And so what you would do is create a striker bill. And it could look like, when you're looking at all these bills, you might see something like a technical correction bill. And that is a striker lifeboat. And what you would do is you need to get that striker bill. It's basically kind of a fake bill. You need to get it through the first committee in the origination chamber. So if you're, whatever, you get through that first committee. And then from there, it needs to go through the House floor. And then what you can do is when it goes over to the opposite chamber, it gets assigned to a committee. And if you need to use it for maybe your original, one of your legislative priorities died, or maybe it's going really well and you have a friend who's a lawmaker and their bill legislative priority is dying and they're reaching out to you and saying, hey, Steve, you have a striker vehicle I can borrow. And then you would give them that bill to use for a topic that you cared about also that you supported. And you can completely delete the language of that lifeboat and put in your own language on this new policy. And it has to go, and you essentially skip an entire chamber in a sense. So now you're in the opposite chamber in a committee, and that bill has to be heard in that committee. So it's still very public, still gets debated on quite a bit. Goes through that committee, goes through the opposite chamber's floor, and then it has to go back for a final read in the original chamber. So your members will still have to be able to do that. So strikers are amazing. I love that you find them so fascinating too, because I do too. I think that they're you really got to stay on your toes though, kind of watch where are the vehicles, who's going to do what. You can get a sense of who's going to strike or different language based on what's been getting killed. But also people use it as a surprise tactic as well. So maybe your whole intent was to keep this hidden until it shows up in that opposite chamber, and then boom, you drop your striker with this new language and surprise your opposition.
So I don't want to oversimplify here, but my example I use to highlight this. So you introduce a bill that requires all poodles in Arizona to be painted pink. That's a bad example. I'm not, no animal abuse, but you know what I'm saying. And that bill might end up coming out is a bill to fund low-income housing.
That's right.
Let's talk about, one of my biggest disappointments this year, Steve, was, if folks aren't familiar with LIHTC, it's the low-income housing tax credit. It's one of the principal elements that helps facilitate affordable housing here in the state of Arizona. That program needed to be extended this year, and the legislature failed to do that. And I can't help but think that is going to be just such a huge detriment. I mean, there's no secret here, Steve, that we're in the middle of a housing affordability crisis, and we need to get more units in the ground. And to have such an important tool like LIHTC not make it through the session, I'm severely disappointed.
It's incredibly disappointing, and it's more than just the legislature's fault. It's all the electeds in the legislature, but also the governor's office too had a big part of this responsibility. And I think when you look back at LIHTC, this is a Ronald Reagan program. That's when this was created. This is a way for private enterprise, the private market, to build housing affordably. Because I think all the listeners understand that we don't have a free market in housing right now because it's overregulated. There's no way for the free market to build enough homes and make it affordable because of our current processes in home building create additional costs in every step of the process. So you cannot build affordably naturally if you wanted to. So because I'm a free market guy, so this is a good policy because you don't have a free market in housing right now. And what's fascinating too is you get opposition from both parties around this topic. Some Republicans don't like LIHTC because they think it's too much of the trading of the tax credit on the open market, even though this is still a private builder building it, but I think there's some confusion. They think it's, government built housing. That's not at all what it is. This is a response to poor government planning and building in the past. So this is private market building housing. And I guarantee none of your listeners could drive past a LIHTC property and know that it was a LIHTC property versus a market rate property. They're beautiful. And then some Democrats don't like it because it's a tax credit and takes away from the general fund, which should go to education. I'm oversimplifying both the Republican and Democrat arguments, but the point is some Republicans don't like it. Some Democrats don't like it. And then in Congress, just recently, the President Trump and the Republicans in Congress expanded and strengthened federal LIHTC, because there's a federal LIHTC program, but many states have their own. And unfortunately, Arizona is the first state to have its own state LIHTC program and then delete it by not reinvesting in it. And anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I'm just, and this kind of reminds me, Steve, of to some extent the what was happening with the film tax credits. And it frustrated me to no end, because you had certain elements of the legislature saying no government money, no giveaways, blah blah blah. And it's like, look, you don't understand. Those tax credits aren't drawn down until after those production companies have already spent the money. You're not, you're not throwing cash at them that might never, result in jobs or tax income in the local. It kind of frustrates me. Right. So what, coming back to LIHTC, what happens now? Are we stuck? Are we going to have a year without this until the next legislature goes into session? Or I mean, do you see another end around on this, Steve?
I'm an eternal optimist, and, you know, sometimes when you have a disappointing setback like we had with this outcome, with this budget, with LIHTC specifically, the next thought that I have is, well, this is an opportunity to do LIHTC bigger, faster, stronger next year. We will have a year where there's nothing going on, which is really disappointing when you're in a housing crisis and you need to be continuously moving and building. And also, what kind of message did we just send to all these builders across the nation? We just said, Arizona doesn't want to build anymore. We really like high rents here. We really like increased homelessness, things like that. And so why would you come here as a builder? So we're going to have to restart all that. But the positive side, I think, is that we could rethink this program and make it more efficient, make it bigger, make it more attractive to Arizona residents, and make them, you know, education to lawmakers around what this is, and to the governor's office, frankly, because there was limited resources in the budget, but these resources could have been found for this. When where the resources were spent, we could have made this happen. It was really disappointing to see that it didn't happen.
Well, especially as you mentioned, given the feds, you know, strengthened it.
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been an ideal strike point to get this done. I guess in fairness, you said there's plenty of blame to go around on this, but that was one of my priorities. And it's just very, very disappointing. Steve, when we come back, I'd like to maybe, because you are the optimist, maybe you're playing the good cop, I'm playing the bad cop here. Because you are the optimist, I'd like to chat about maybe some of the other wins this last legislative session.
Yeah, sounds great.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Buehler-Garcia, BBG, setting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. If you'd like to interact, give us a call. Take advantage of Steve's pantheon of knowledge, 790-2040. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Buehler-Garcia, BBG, sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Steve, I don't know how much you've done radio, but the part that folks miss is typically when you see the host head bobbing to the bumper music, that's a good sign. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Steve Kaiser of Policy Forge, which is a lobbying organization, a governmental advocacy, whatever you want to call it. Steve, you touched on something that frustrates me to no end, and that is the disconnect between what certain elected officials say and what they do. So, for example, locally here in Tucson, you know, everybody agrees we've got a housing affordability crisis, we need to do something about it. And then the next week, they pass regulations that make it more expensive to build housing, whether that's multifamily or single family or whatever it is. And it just, I grip my teeth. I'm there at the podium and I want to say, what don't you understand about this? You know, what I've seen studies that say up to 40% of the cost of building housing nationwide are nothing but government fees and regulations. It's not lumber. Mm-hmm. It's not concrete. It's not labor. It's rules. And that just makes my head explode. I don't know how we get around that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to kind of get into the details on it, because I think it's really easy for people to say, I support affordable housing, right? That's easy. Right. It's easy to say. It's difficult to continue that thought when you get a direct question about affordable housing. So, for instance, why does 40% of the cost, why is regulation 40% of the cost? What does that even mean? Well, what that means is carrying costs. So I own this dirt. I didn't pay for it outright. I financed it. So I have a carrying cost on that dirt. The longer this regulatory process takes, the more expensive my holding costs are. That's one way regulation costs increase it, because I'm not going to go bankrupt on this deal. Mm-hmm. That cost has to go to that front door when I sell it or rent it. Otherwise, I'm out of business. And then one of the other things is all these additional items that either councils or, you know, planning commissions or staff add on to projects. You know, we need to have golden gargoyles on the outside or brick facing pop outs, and, you know, all these expensive little niche things that aren't necessary if you're trying to build a beautiful home that's up to code, it's safe. You know, nothing I'm saying is saying we're cutting safety cut corners or anything like that. So that's where all these little costs go up, and that's why we don't have a free market either, because somebody's dictating what you can do with your product and your land. So it's easy to say you support affordable housing because it's popular to say that. It's harder to say this is how we should do it, because then you start stepping on toes.
And I want to distinguish for our listeners out there that the difference between affordable housing, because people get a certain image in their mind when they hear that phrase in that order. What we have is a housing affordability crisis. And that includes many different elements, including subsidized, or what traditionally folks would think of is affordable housing. We just need to get more rooftops on the ground. A perfect local example, Steve, now going on several years ago, the Tucson Mayor and Council passed a regulation that requires electric vehicle charging infrastructure in all new buildings. And 1% of the people in the state of Arizona drive electric vehicles. You know, you talk about the famous 1%. That's a perfect example. But on average, the numbers I heard, this would add another $500,000 to the cost of your standard 200-250 unit, you know, garden style apartment complex. And like you mentioned, that all adds up. It's the cut of the death of a thousand cuts. And then to make matters worse, after a year after the regulation went into place, the city itself did a survey, and they found that people just weren't using it. And you know, and you got this experience with government, of course. Nothing ever goes away, no matter how bad it turns out the regulation is. So, And folks, just a reminder that we do have a election coming up for the Tucson City Council, wards 3, 5, and who am I missing? 3, 5, and 6 are open coming up. You're probably, if you don't have a ballot yet already, you'll have one in your mail. And please do your duty and vote, and maybe, you know, do your research, and let's see if we can get some folks down there who have got a more business-friendly attitude so we don't have these sorts of things. Steve, we had, I'm not a fan of the legislature coming in and telling local municipalities what to do. I'll lay that out front. But I know last legislative session, they seemed to be the only governing body that was giving us some tools that we could use to address the housing affordability crisis, the missing middle regulations they passed, the legislation that allows folks to convert industrial properties for residential. Were there any other wins this session?
Yeah, I think so. One of my favorite bills was that AMA bill, like converting the old dead retail center of, like, I think the old Target or Kmart, and you can convert that to residential housing by right. That was amazing. That was an AMA bill, and that was working with the cities on that bill too, to get them on board. And we did a cleanup bill this last session around that bill to make it even more efficient and a little bit tighter. There are some questions from one of the cities in the valley around it, and so we answered some of those questions with a cleanup bill and made it a little bit better in the process. And so that's the kind of bill that I love working on, because you collaborate with the other side, you find solutions. It's not always about being a wrecking ball, because, by the way, a wrecking ball approach tends to not get anything done. So you do need to be collaborative down there. You do need to listen to the other side, and you do need to compromise. And that became a great bill where you can convert old commercial buildings and lots. You can completely scrape them and rebuild residential housing. That's amazing. Another bill I worked on this session for the Senate president was a bill that came out of a city, the city of Maricopa. And the city of Maricopa had done pre-approved single-family home plans. And so basically, if you were a resident of Maricopa, you could go to the city office and say, I'd like to pull one of your pre-approved design plans and see if you like it. If you like it, you can take that plan and cut through all the red tape that you normally would have to. You don't have to hire an architect. You don't have to go through design review. You don't have to do all these things. You can start building much faster. And so the Senate president said, Steve, let's expand on this. What can we do to expand on this and make this statewide? And so we took that and we expanded the single family home piece. We said, you've got to create, you know, three different elevations for single family homes from 800 square feet to 2000 square feet, I think it was. Then you had to create plans for duplex and triplex, and then also plans for ADUs. Cause as we know, the ADU bill passed a couple years ago where you can have ADUs on your property. And wouldn't it be nice though, if you had your city had pre-approved ADU plans where you could take a look at their library of plans, And it's not just city developed ones. These can also be developed by private architects as well. But they're pre-approved by the city, and you can look in their catalog and say, oh, you know what? I really like that design. You pull that design off the city shelf, and you immediately start building your ADU on your property for a much lower cost. And so I just love anytime we can streamline things, we can get government out of the way, we can cut that red tape. That's just another beautiful example of that.
Now, Steve, I want to be very clear. Tucson does not have any run-down, abandoned retail properties anywhere in our city, Fort Lowell, First Avenue.
I believe it. The one city that doesn't have any, right, I believe right. it.
But I will give props to our local city staff here. They did early on with, and folks, if you don't know, ADU is an accessory dwelling unit, a casita, a guest house, if you will. But the local city staff here at the city of Tucson did have a competition among architects, and they do have a portfolio now of pre-approved designs that folks can just choose from, and it saves a lot of time and money because Lord knows architects and you know engineers aren't cheap. Steve, when we come back, I'd like to chat a little bit about some of the weird bills that maybe you saw going through the legislature. But before I do that, what I want people to appreciate the dynamic up there at the legislature, because this was a pretty rough and tumble session. And I think this is one of the first time in many, many years we really tiptoed up to that threshold where we were looking at a potential government shutdown because we couldn't get the budget negotiations complete. And what was interesting to me is, yes, we do have a divided government, if you will, right now. The Republicans control the House and Senate. And then, of course, we have a Democrat in the executive office and the governor's office. But some of the more interesting dynamics here that I saw this session was the battles between the Republicans themselves.
Yeah, I think we've always, not always, but it feels like in recent memory, we've tiptoed close to that end of June signing die date, right? But I think what was so different and strange this year was the kind of lack of coordination between all the different players down there, like the key players. And it was very public and it was very out in the open about what was like just the infighting. And usually you wouldn't see any of that. Usually it'd be behind the scenes. Things would be getting coordinated, worked out, you know, questions answered. And then it would take forever, but it would be a little bit more coordinated and behind the scenes and answering questions. But this was much more like personal attacks out in the open, a lot of infighting. And as a Republican, it was kind of disappointing to see all that and watch that kind of happen. And really, because the Senate and the House should be united if they're the same party against an opposition, political party in the governor's office. But, you know, it's easier for the governor to, in any historical period, it's easier for the governor to separate one of the chambers from the other one. And so that's what happened again here. But yeah, it was really a strange session for sure.
Steve, can you stick around and spend a little bit more time with us after the break?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Cool. Very cool. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. If you'd like to have a question or comment, give us a call, 790-2040. We'll be back with more with Steve Kaiser of Policy Forge. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, your guest host, pardon me, Ted, sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. If you'd like to give us a call, the lines are open, 790-2040. Pardon me a little bit, I'm geeking out about the legislature with Steve Kaiser. He's the founder and the principal of Policy Forge, which is an advocacy group based out of Phoenix. And we're talking about this last legislative session. And you might, don't tune out, ladies and gentlemen. These folks are making decisions that affect every one of us in our pocketbooks directly. So it's important that you at least generally pay attention. And again, I want to remind you, we do have the CD7 special election is taking place today. Do not, obviously it's too late to put your ballot in the mail, but you can also go to pima.gov/elections to find the voting centers that are open until 7 p.m. tonight. Huge decision for those folks in CD7. Also, we do have 3 city council races coming up again this summer and later into the fall. So make sure you do your research and get involved in that. Steve, I'm going to use a phrase that is maybe not in good stead right now, but, you know, king for a day. If Steve Kaiser, I know we're not supposed to have kings, but let's just say, you know, hypothetical, if Steve Kaiser was king, what would you like to see come out of the legislature next session that could help address the housing affordability crisis in our state and our communities?
Wow.
You want to think on that for a little bit?
No. I mean, I think, I think in general, just reducing regulations, going back to property rights, private property rights, but more specifically, I'd like to see more opportunities for home ownership for folks that don't even think they can ever own a home because the median home price is $500,000 and the average age to purchase a home now is 38 years old, which is insane. I'd like to see us be able to, have homes at a price where folks can purchase those that are, half of, maybe their starter home should be, $250,000 or $200,000 instead of $500,000. So I'd like to find ways for home ownership for sure. And just as a side note too, for your listeners about, the best part of being a member is that you can come up with any bill that pops into your little head and then you can run it. The problem is getting it heard and seen. But for your listeners, that goes to them as well, because if they can develop a relationship with their state lawmakers, they can then influence their state lawmakers to run bills for them. That's how it's supposed to work. And that was my very first bill that I ran and got signed, was a bill from a constituent who I was, longtime PC with myself that I knew for a long time. He came to me with this idea. I loved it. And we ran it together, basically. So I would tell your listeners, build that relationship with their state lawmakers, and then their ideas can then become bills very easily.
Very, very good advice. I know, Steve, I'm working with some folks down in Nogales, and they're looking to build some housing there. Of course, you've got a couple mines opening up down in that region, so they're looking to address that. And one thing that people don't think about very often, too, is people might be able to afford the mortgage or the financing. Hopefully, the rates will come down. The Fed will finally do something. But it's that the down payment, ideally the 20% that is a threshold that people have trouble getting over. So I'd like to see some way if we could address that and help folks along with that. Steve, want to have a little bit of fun here today because I don't want to get too dry for the listeners. Tip of the hat to Ray Stern from the Arizona Republic. He had an article about his top five oddball bills that came out of the legislature and were signed. They didn't die in the House or the Senate or, didn't get a committee hearing. So these are new laws that are going to take effect September 26th. And one of them involves something called the Advanced Air Mobility Fund, which, ladies and gentlemen, if you're not familiar with that, we're basically looking at flying cars like the Jetsons cartoon.
This is incredible. And I happen to be very lucky to sit down with Senator Farnsworth kind of impromptu, just in the hallway, like a good lobbyist. I was hanging out in the hallway for the lobby, I should say. And we started chatting, and he was telling me all about this bill. And I love Senator Farnsworth. He is the nicest guy. He takes his job very serious, and he's very serious about this topic. And at first you almost kind of want to laugh, and he kind of laughed when he was describing it initially to me. But then as he talked more about it, he does have a strong point. I mean, I had no idea these products were already out there. So that was number one lesson learned for me. It's like, well, there's already products that can create flying cars. It's insane. And Arizona has a history now with Waymo and some of these other things like Uber of, pioneering innovative technologies. And we should have some kind of a way to focus and do this in a safe, smart way. One of the bills I ran was a regulatory sandbox bill that basically said you can test out new things, new innovative ways to do things with new technology in a sandbox where you can kind of have a safe place to test out new things without regulatory burdens crushing, infant technologies and things like that. So I feel like the regulatory sandbox could be a good fit for what he's trying to do from a regulatory standpoint, but he's creating this little fund to also create, landing pads and spaces to test these things. And it's incredible.
I don't know how. I've got mixed feelings about that, Steve, because I mean, I don't know what it's like up in the Valley, but Tucson drivers are crazy enough on the asphalt. I don't know how I feel about them taking to the air, but it allocates $2 million, as you mentioned, to create the Advanced Air Mobility Fund, which would buy flying cars for testing and demonstration purposes. I guess we'll see how that works out.
it's going to be, I think the next, you know, 10 to 15 years in this industry is going to be really incredible. I just can't believe that the product's already out there. But when I look up and I see a flying car in 10 years, I'm going to laugh and think about this phone call we're having right now.
Well,
maybe it'll be quicker than 10 years.
Now, kind of related, but not necessarily. There's also a bill that talked about, the ability to shoot down drones, I guess, for lack of a better term. You know, folks have gotten that's more concerned about that with the presence of drones around. And I know this is a big issue with the governor and the legislature this year about, you know, foreign governments buying land near military bases. But this legislation addresses that now. Now, don't get me wrong, folks. You can't just willy-nilly go out there and shoot down drones. But it started to address that potential problem.
Yeah, this is such a funny one too, because I live in typical suburban subdivision where I've got a two-story house behind me with windows that look in my backyard, right? I hate that. Mm-hmm. But I've also had an instance, but I live with that. I don't want to shoot out their windows. But I've also had an instance where an errant drone flew over my backyard. Somebody was playing around with a drone, and I immediately got mad, and I wanted to shoot it down with something, like a BB gun or something, right? And so I kind of get the raw emotion around how the invasion of privacy that drones have and stuff like that. But this is a new technology again. We have to find out the balance of, privacy versus this is my private property versus I should be able to fly wherever I want feelings. I don't know.
My main concern is, given the melding of the two, what happens if somebody accidentally shoots down a flying car thinking it's a drone spying on them? Who's going to have the liability for that, Steve?
It's a great question. Maybe we should make armor-plated our flying cars.
Don't complicate things, brother. We do have a caller called us here at the Morning Voice, 790-2040, has a question for you, Steve, about Boxable, which I'm not familiar with. Apparently, it's something from Elon Musk. Caller, thanks for joining us. What's your question or comment here? Oh, he's not. Thanks,
Brandon. No, he just left a quick message for us.
Okay, so Steve, do you know what Boxable is? Because I sure don't.
Yeah, I've heard of it, and I believe it is. Gosh, I'm going to kind of butcher it, but I think it's prefabricated kind of housing where it's. I think they use something similar to shape and the size of shipping containers, and there's ways to make them, you know, modular and build them to what you need as far as housing goes. Very effective and efficient in building process. And it kind of goes back to, you know, why are we still building with stick built on-site lumber and nails? We could be building in a warehouse off-site and then shipping the pieces to the lot and then building it like a connector set, essentially. That would save tons of costs. So why aren't we doing more of that? Are there regulatory things we can streamline to make that more feasible? You know, building it in a warehouse instead of building it on site with lumber and nails and one tool at a time kind of thing. So
yeah, my crack engineer here, Brandon, brought up some photos of that, and it does look like pretty much, yeah, just ready, you know, throw in a pad, some utilities, and plunk it down. And coming back to the regulatory side of that, are there potential issues? I know there was at least a local municipality here, Steve, who's like, we need more housing, we need more housing, we need more housing. But, Lord, you know, God forbid, not those prefabricated, you know, mobile home. So it's like, you know, they want their cake and eat it too. So
it totally. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for the caller for bringing that information up. Let's get back to our now, here's a bill that I do agree with, Steve, that came out of this year's legislative session as I shuffle my notes here. It's a bill that would make artificial intelligence child porn illegal. Now, Arizona already has some of the strictest laws, addressing child pornography. But this bill, House Bill 2678, would also make it illegal if an artificial image depicts a minor. And I think that's, I don't know if I want to call this a crazy bill, because I think that's actually a good thing, because AI right now is just
it's crazy.
Out of control.
Yeah. There was another bill last year that was in similar vein, and this is such a tough topic, but it was banning sex dolls that were basically look like minors or something like that. And these are being made in China, and you can purchase them apparently. And what's even crazier is there was people that testified in support of that. I'm sorry, in opposition, because I was trying to say those are illegal in Arizona. You cannot have that for obvious reasons. And there was a group that, you know, went down there and said, no, we should be allowed to have that. And wow. it's just the debates you hear down there just blow your mind. It's just incredible.
Now, don't these folks have to register before they address the committee or legislature? And I mean, I want to know who's down there advocating for that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll leave that for another day. Steve, if you don't mind, let me take a real quick break here and pay for the show. And then when we come back, we'll wrap up with our discussion about this year's legislature. Are you good with that?
Okay. Yes, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bueller Garcia, BBG, sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. Don't forget, we've got Kathleen Wynn with Wynn Tucson coming up, and lots of other. Dr. Ed Ackerley will be guest hosting for Grant Krueger tomorrow, right here, begin at 7 a.m. Lots of good stuff here on KVOI, your trusted local news and talk source. Welcome back to The Morning Voice, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Bueller Garcia sitting in for Ted Maxwell here on The Morning Voice. We're talking with Steve Kaiser, who is the founder and principal of Policy Forge, which is an advocacy group working out of Phoenix. We're talking about the legislature. Steve, real quick, just on one other bill I want to touch on that was signed by the governor, House Bill 2374. Now, it's already, you know, illegal to stalk or threaten or harass people, but this bill would make it even more bad if you do it professionally. Can you explain to me what a professional harasser is? I mean, do people actually get paid to do this?
I guess so. I'm not exactly sure what the intent of, I didn't follow that bill too closely, so I would probably need to talk to the lawmaker and the groups behind the lawmaker on this bill. But this is a serious problem. Like, this happened a lot when I was there. The security aspect of being a lawmaker, I don't know if you saw those lawmakers get the husband get assassinated recently in the other state.
Tragedy.
I mean, getting death threats is just part of the norm now. And I had a situation where I thought somebody was at my house because I'd received death threats too. And I thought somebody had pulled up in front of my house right after I dropped my kids off, and they went into the house, and I went to the mailbox at the street. Truck pulls in front of my house. I was like, oh, this is the guy. And I pulled my gun out of my truck, and I was standing in my garage, and I was like, I'm going to have to shoot somebody because this is a guy that's been threatening me. And the person got out of the truck, and it was a friend of mine. I just didn't recognize the truck because I'd never seen this truck. Yeah. So I was like, prepared to kill somebody in my driveway because of all this bull.
Wow.
So it's real. It's out there, and there should be stiffer penalties. People think they're anonymous, and they get real tough online. But there should be serious penalties.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, Steve, we're going to wrap up here, but I really appreciate you spending your time and your knowledge with us here today. One, I mentioned this, these kind of five oddball bills, but was there something that you witnessed this session that you'd also add to the list, that whether it got signed by the governor or not, that just seemed kind of, makes you scratch your head?
I feel like there's always bills when I'm sitting in committee waiting for my bill to be heard. I just kind of start laughing. I'm like, really? Wow, that's a bill, and that made it through committee, and that got heard? I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now on a specific topic, but like I said earlier, that is the best part of being a lawmaker, is you can come up with any idea that pops into your little head, and it can become a proposed bill. And especially if you're a committee chair, it's going to be heard in your committee because you're the committee chair. You get to pick what's heard. So you do see some wild stuff, which makes it pretty entertaining.
All right. Well, go back to your decompression stage, Steve, and we appreciate you sharing your knowledge with our listeners here on the Morning Voice.
Thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, brother. Be safe.
All right. See ya. Bye.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. Just a reminder that we've got lots of cool events coming up here as part of the pantheon of shows here at KVOI. And don't forget, you know, I'm a little shameless promotion here, Brendan. There's lots of great content on the weekends as well. So it's not just weekdays here at KVOI. Tomorrow, Dr. Ed Ackerley will be sitting in for Grant Krueger. His guests will be Trey White from KGUN and Rob Bonneau from KLD. They'll be talking about the state of local television here in the Pueblo. Coming up in just a few minutes immediately after us, Kathleen Wynn with Wynn Tucson. And don't forget, we do have an eat and greet. If you'd like to meet the Morning Voice team, that's going to be taking place July 24th, 5:30 at the Javelina, which, if you're not familiar with that, that's in the Doubletree by Hilton at Reed Park, right there on Avernon between 22nd and Broadway. That's July 24th. from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Coming up Thursday on The Morning Voice, Tom Moulton will be broadcasting live from the Arizona Governor's Conference on Tourism from Phoenix. That should be very interesting. And then Friday, Dr. Ed Ackley is back again with Success Stories. Definitely something you want to tune in for here. Brendan, I just want to touch on something real quick, if you don't mind, because it's been in the news quite a bit, and it just breaks my heart. I was, part of the way I paid for college is fighting wildfires, so I'm quite familiar with this, and just a huge tragedy. These two wildfires up in northern Arizona, which have destroyed about 70 structures so far, including the historic and absolutely gorgeous Grand Canyon Lodge. I don't know. Did you ever visit there, spend some time there?
No, unfortunately, I did not. But it is quite tragic.
Yeah, it's a beautiful lodge. And, of course, there's a lot of debate right now. I know the governor has jumped in with both feet on this, wanting to find out what was going on. Apparently, they were doing, you know, bucket drops, aerial drops, to try and keep the fire away from that lodge. But there was a chlorine gas leak that made them have to pull, you know, the personnel out of there, because of course chlorine gas is no bueno. So it's just a all around tragedy, and just sorry to hear that. But a related factor, we're talking about housing with Steve Kaiser. The you know, you may think of it, okay, that's a long ways away, that's up in the Grand Canyon, but an article just came out that shows that wildfires are now becoming a factor in Arizona housing costs, given what's happening in California. A lot of those Californians are leaving. They're coming to Arizona to move in here. And frankly, you know, the risks that have been created in California, that's causing insurers all across the country to raise rates on everyone. So, you know, they're facing growing losses and weather disasters. In fact, it's my understanding that in northern Arizona, some homeowners cannot even find coverage at all. So you might want to keep an eye on that, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a pleasure sitting in here for Ted Maxwell. This has been Ben Bueller Garcia here on The Morning Voice. Don't forget to tune in. I'll be back at noon on the Bill Buckmaster Show, and definitely stick around for Kathleen Wynn and Wynn Tucson right here on 1030 The Voice, your trusted source for local news and talk. Be safe out there, ladies and gentlemen.